So one focus I'll have is to show how the scaling behavior, which I'll come back to, of tree amplitudes and something called on-shell recursion relations lie behind most of the insight that we found until now about this this duality. And since I'll be talking about methods, my talk will be a little more technical than parallels. So I'll get into some detail, some facts. Okay. So what I'll talk about, first I'll give you some preliminaries, a bit of notation on things, and what we've known, what we know already about similarities between these two theories. I'll tell you something about MHV rule constructions, which exist for both theories now, which are sort of similar, but not completely. That's at tree level. Then I'll talk a bit more about one loop structure of n equals 4 and n equals 8, and show some of the arguments that lead to this no triangle conjecture or no triangle hypothesis that these are sort of the same in one loop or have the same structure. And then I'll end saying something about all loops, conclusion, outlook, etc. But first, some preliminaries. So when I talk about n equals 4 superangles here, what I'll mean is, well, this is the things I'll be using, that it's maximally supersymmetric gauge theory in four dimensions, contains one vector, four split half, fermions, three convex scalars, all in the adjoint, and then it's low energy limit of some superstring theory. Now, it has super conformal symmetry in exactly four dimensions, which is, well, it has the four symmetries, which sort of it has, but in four dimensions, it has this, this extra conformal symmetry that comes in also, sort of special there. A very important thing here is that it's ultraviolet finite in four dimensions. Okay, so just so before I get the same question as Harold got about what I'm going to mean when I talk about amplitudes and S matrices in n equals four, in exactly four dimensions, of course, these are not well defined because they're infrared singularities, like in any matrix theory, really QED has them also. So this is an irregulated version where we go to 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions, and of course we don't have the exact symmetry there.
QED, you can solve the problem, here you cannot. Here you can sum of soft photons.
Well, still you have to make a, well, if you make a, an infrared cutoff, as I would say, if it goes to 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions, then you are. I mean, then you have something you can call the net matrix. Okay, I don't want to get far into the argument, but the point is these are infrared regulated theories, and it is well defined there. Okay, so n equals 8 supergravity. Again, the maximally supersymmetric gravity theory in four dimensions has one graviton, and spin 3 half fermions, and so on, 5 level particles. You don't really want to actually write down the Lagrangian for this theory. Well, you might want to, but it's a mess. You can get it from a dimensional reduction of n equals 1 supergravity in 11 dimensions, and again, limit of string theory. But here we'll be talking about perturbative supergravity. So what's this? Well, final vertices, they go as momentum squared, the two derivatives in the Ricci scalar. And you have vertices to all orders in the number of particles. You have a dimensional full coupling constant. That's normally bad. This would normally lead to non-renormalizable theories, as it does for less supersymmetric gravity theories. In particular, n equals 0, just ordinary gravity, is pretty badly non-renormalizable. And any Feynman Eigen calculation, it's really really ugly. It'll take up pages and pages just a four graviton scattering amplitude if you don't do something about it. Okay, a bit about notation. When I talk about gauge theories, I'll use the color ordering notation, which means that if I have say a four gluon amplitude where the gluon have colors A, B, C, and D, I can sort of take all the color informations in the structure constants and take them outside and write them as a trace over generation matrices. And then the coefficient is then well, color over amplitude. So it just means that the cyclic ordering in here has to match the cyclic ordering of colors out here. So it's important that we keep the same cyclic ordering when we're talking about the color ordered amplitudes. The research calculates because there's no color information in them. You just have to calculate more of them to get the full amplitude. The other thing is the spherical listing notation. So whenever we have momenta, in general, we'll multiply them by the sigma matrix, so you get a 2x2 matrix. If that's massless momentum, you can write that as product of two component spinners, which we can call lambdas. We'll also use this notation. The one with the angle bracket is normally called the anti-holomorphic spinner, and the other one is, well, sorry, it's called the holomorphic spinner, and the square bracket is called the anti-holomorphic spinners. If we want to express an amplitude in terms of these, well, we have to know the polarizations also. We choose a basis, or a helicity basis for this, where we say that the plus polarization is given like this, and the minus like this. So what we have in this expression is, for instance, so this one down here is an anti-symmetric inner product of two spinners. Okay. The P is, again, you make this spin and you get these two spinners, and you can plug that in here. And the Q is just some random momentum or some random spinner. Okay, or can't be completely random because can't be the same as P because this is an anti-symmetric inner anti-symmetric product. They don't want that zero. But that's a sort of gauge choice which one you use there. Of course, the same here. Right. So I'll talk about one previous known similarity because between n equals 4 and n equals 8. Of course, there are loads more of them, but I'll focus on this one. So it's the KLT relations, which come out of considerations of string scattering amplitudes. And what they more or less say is that gravity is some sort of gauge theory square. So if you want, say, a 3 gravity amplitude, what you can actually do when you go on shell is just take the product of 2 gauge theory amplitudes. Actually works quite well. And then with 4 you have, well, it gets a bit more complicated because the 2 gauge theory amplitudes, you now have a different ordering of some of the particles. And these are pretty simple expressions, and you have a kinematic invariant in front. It goes to 5, you get more terms in the sum, you get more kinematical invariants, but still the picture is all the same. This is all on shell at tree level. Now, of course, you can put other things in gravitons and gluons in this. So if, say, particle 1 here is graviton, well, over here it has to be a gluon and a gluon in the gauge theories. If it's, say, a spin 3 half particles, well, it can sort of split into a gluon here and a spin half fermion here. Okay, so sort of you can get all these, or you can get a spin 3 half particle or helicity 3 half particle from the helicity 2 particle by hitting it with a supersymmetry. And the 8 supersymmetries of n equals 8 sort of split into two sets. So if you hit it by supersymmetry number 2, then you have to go and over here in the first one, hit it with supersymmetry number 2, because that's in the first group. You can sort of, every particle on the left side corresponds to 2 particles on the right side. Okay. So if you have a lot of different particles in there, it's going to start getting messy, but there's a rule to take care of this. Okay. All right. Now let's talk about on-shell recursion, which is a pretty new thing. So it's, the basic idea is due to Richard Feng and Witten. And actually what it says is just if you want to calculate a tree amplitude, you can choose 2 external particles, say 1 and 2, and make some analytic continuation. You just say, well, you take the spinners and you write them instead as a, well, put something in which depends on some complex variable set. Yeah, that's nice, because then we can do complex analysis. So if we know for sure somehow that when the set goes to infinity, then the amplitude goes to zero, then we can use Cauchy's theorem on this. Because, well, what we want to know is the amplitude at zero. We can write that as just a Cauchy integral around the pole at zero of this quantity. Well, but if we know that, well, if this holds, then the integral at infinity is going to give us zero also. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's going to give us zero also. So we can actually say that the integral here around zero is equal to minus the integral around all the other poles that we have in this amplitude. Right? So that becomes a sum over the residues of this function at all the poles. Now, you can look at what this residue is and what these poles are, and what you find out is that, in fact, what you get is a sum over, well, you get the propagators out, and you get that the residue splits into a product of two on-shell tree amplitudes. Okay, so these depend on this set I in somehow, in some way, right? They're on-shell amplitudes, which you can compute. The set you have to sum over is sort of, if you imagine doing this and then imagine all the Feynman diagrams, then you can simply go and draw where the set dependence goes in this Feynman diagram. And if a propagator has a set dependence, you're going to have a singularity like this in some place. So it's all the propagators that get affected by this analytic continuation at the sum over. Yeah, that can be a lot fewer than for a Feynman diagram calculation. What you normally get is that you get more compact expressions, but they can often contain some unphysical poles that will cancel when you sum up the whole expression. So that's a general rule that you want to make something more compact, you can't really keep it physical. You have to do something which seems unphysical, but what else? So, of course, there was this condition I talked about that like the amplitude had to go to zero as it went to infinity. For gauge theory, we can often just look at the worst Feynman diagram, the Feynman diagram which would be least likely to have this behavior, which is typically made up of just three-point vertices and propagators, and you can simply go and count all the powers of Z and find out that, well, it actually works. It goes like Z to minus one. Often the behavior is actually better than what you can get from this this worst Feynman diagram analysis, which is a consequence of that it's a gauge theory. We're looking at gauge theory because there has to be some internal cancellation between Feynman diagrams that enforces the gauge theory. Well, what about gravity then? Well, if you try to take the worst Feynman diagram, you get an estimate which is, I mean, typically you would get for a 6-point amplitude, you would get that this A would go like, well, would go like Z to the power of 5 or something, which is not good. If you try to use the KLT relation before, you'll often get something which is just as bad. Now, when you actually go and compute these amplitudes and put in this analytic continuation, what you find is that it does actually hold. That's been checked up to something like all 7-point amplitudes that you do actually get good behavior. There are just some unexplained cancellations lurking around in gravity. Okay. So the conclusion is there that we can actually do this recursion of gravity amplitude, but we can't actually strictly prove that we're right. I mean, we all think that we're right, but this is sort of the missing piece of information. And this is going to crop up as a missing piece of information a couple of times more in my talk. So I'll generally here be talking about external gravitons and external gluons. If it's n equals 4 or n state, of course, we can put in all the other particles also. So, of course, generally. So those were the preliminaries. I'll try to go to the MHB constructions and tell you about what they are. So MHB rule for gauge theory starts out by looking at some simple amplitudes, which are, well, we take, well, for instance, if we have an amplitude with just gluons, where all the gluons have plus elasticity, we're just taking them all out joining, so if they came in, they would have minus elasticity. So, and you can actually calculate that this ends up being zero. There's supersymmetry arguments for that, for instance. Also, if there's just one that has a minus, you get zero also. So the first one that you give something apart from zero is some amplitude which has two gluons of negative elasticity and the rest of positive elasticity. Of course, you would flip the elasticities and get the opposite result. We'll just choose it this way. And you get this fairly easy expression for it. I mean, this is an amplitude, this is an n-amplitude, n-point amplitude. If you want to calculate this with Feynman diagrams, it would take you a long time, even though it's just a free amplitude. So the idea is, well, it comes from Cacciato, Svercek, and Witten, that if you want to compute an amplitude which is not maximally helicity violating, MHV, then you can actually do it by just taking these amplitudes and considering them as being vertices in some theory, some diagrammatic theory. You can string them together with just ordinary scalar propagators, and then with the rule that at each end of a propagator you have to have a plus at one end and a minus at the other. This apparently works. So for external lines here, well, you just plug in whatever the spinner is. For internal lines, you don't have an on-shell momentum there. It's off-shell, so it's somehow need to choose another momentum to put into the formula here. And what you do is, well, you choose some eta, and you subtract a sufficient amount of momentum in order to make it on-shell. Just have to use the same eta all the time. Again, that's all the gauge parameter. There's another way of saying this, that is that if you just want the spinner, you can write it as sort of the original momentum contracted into the anthropomorphic spinner phase to equivalent weights at this point, say. So this has a very deep connection to twisted string theory, which I won't actually be talking about here, but all this can come out of considering string theory in twisted spaces within this. And that's sort of what I want to say about that. So there is a relation to string theory here, which which is not the standard one, which you'd expect, but that's sort of the start of the whole thing. Okay, so an example of how these rules work. Well, if we want to calculate this 6-gluon amplitude, it's sort of next to maximally helicity violating, that's three minuses. You get diagrams like this, where you always have two minuses, here and here, here and here. And then you take the expressions you had before and just plug in like whatever it says in the diagram, only that the internal momentum here has to be this projected momentum. And you do some calculations and you get something that looks like this. And you get, I don't remember the number, it's the order of like 5-10 diagrams for calculating a full 6-point amplitude, which is sort of neat compared to final rules.
So if you add all the diagrams, it cancels out?
It cancels out, yes. And that's by no means trivial, but it does. Okay, so now I want to tell you a bit about how this relates to the recursion relations I talked about before. So really, you can sort of see how this is true by considering it not as a string theory in twisted space or something, but actually as just something which comes out of recursion relations and complex analysis. So what you could do if you want to calculate this next to MHV amplitude with three minuses and a lot of pluses, I didn't write, then you can again make some analytic continuation, which I've written here. You take the anthropomorphic spinners of the negative elasticity particles and make an analytic continuation, do this in like a cyclical way, so get the end product of M3 and then one for the next one, and so on. So in this way, using these regression relations or the principle, then you get something which always splits into. So as you had before, you have a propagator, and then you have an amplitude which is unshelled on each side of the propagator. Now it depends on this set here, because you had to make this one unshelled in order to make it work. Now, this is not exactly what is in the MHV rules, because these are sort of the right amplitudes for them, because we have this analytically continued MJ instead of this one. But happily, it doesn't actually appear in the expression we have to plug it into, because this MHV expression only has the angle brackets. So we don't see it, but we don't ever see it, that's fine. And then you can, in a similar way, calculate that sort of the internal momentum has a holomorphic spin, which is the same one as you would need for the MHV rules. And so it comes out this way. Now, what if you have more than three negative loops to gluons? Well, you have four, for instance. Well, if you do something similar, you just choose some other set of these A's. There's some conditions on them. And, well, the first, when you do recursion the first time, you split it in a certain amplitude, where at the propagator and then an MHV and next to MHV. And, well, then you sort of play the game again, do it once more, and you split this one into a product of two MHVs and another propagator. And there are some tweaks and twists I won't tell you about here, but then in the end you get out the MHV rules in the same way. What you need to assume to make this work is actually just the concept of an MHV amplitude, more or less. That you have something which you can call that. And then there, for the recursion to work, you need to, when you do this shift the first time, you need to know that the whole amplitude, if it has, this is, means n plus 2 negative velocity particles, gluons, or gravitons, that it must go as set to minus n. Right? Now, for gauge theory, that's just, again, looking at the worst Feynman diagram, you can imagine. And you get this, it works, and this is another trick also. Now, this seems to work for gravity also, or for gravity in general. Well, there are MHV amplitudes in gravity. You can get them from, say, the KLT relations. So there's the complication that you don't have this nice structure with only the angle brackets, only the holomorphic spin is being used. The anti-holomorphic spinners are also in there. Okay, so that's going to make things a bit more complicated. The expressions are not going to be so nice, but doesn't prevent us from actually doing it. And what we would, of course, like to know is if there's some relation to a twisted formulation of gravity. Because that would increase your understanding of what's actually going on here. Because we can make these things just like an NH4, but we don't actually really know why. It's sort of a mystery. So again, as I said, the problem is that we can't prove this asymptotic behavior that it has to have. We just know that the actual behavior is way better than the naive expectation. We can, for all the examples we know of graviton amplitudes, we can compute it and see that it is all right. We can do this. So again, we have the problem that the understanding of gravity or supergravity depends on the validity of such recursion relations or scaling behavior. So it makes a difference. Okay. So now I want to go to the one loop structure of the similarities in one loop structure of the n equals 4 superangles and we'll say gravity. So So first I want to tell you about what we know about the structure of one loop amplitudes in general. So we take all the Feynman diagrams, compute them, and sum them. And you get some expressions. You use various reduction methods, and you can then prove that any massless one loop amplitude can be written as a linear combination of, well, of scalar integrals in the way that you have a sum over coefficients, and then times, you just see this as just the product of the four propagations here integrated. So this is a sort of scalar integral. And you have to sum over all the different ways of assigning the legs to different corners here. And you get a different coefficient for each one. The same with the triangles or bubbles, and then in the end you get typically some rational terms also, which don't need sort of an integration of the loop on itself. For n equals 4, there's some cancellations that reduces this to boxes only. So if you just imagine a one loop Feynman diagram that consists of three vertices only, then you would have like n powers of loop momentum if there are n gluons, each coming into each of these three vertices, and you'd have these n propagations also. Now, supersymmetry reduces this power by 4, and then you can use these reduction methods, and each power here goes with one propagator, and you can see that you always have at least 4 propagators left. Okay, so that's what happens in n equals 4 angles, and we know that. So what about n equals 8 supergravity? Well, naively, a one-point angular amplitude can have up to 2 n powers. Remember I told you that the vertices have power 2 in the momenta. So every time on a loop that you have a vertex, you have 2 powers of momentum. They're the same number of propagators, of course. There's a reduction, again, from supersymmetry that takes away 8 powers now. But there are only n propagators that these dots cancel. So there's lots of loop momentum left in the numerator to just start canceling these propagators. And once they're canceled, you're going to have triangles, you're going to have bubbles, and you're going to have rational pieces popping up. And if you do the analysis, then for a 4-point amplitude, it's just boxes. For a 5-point one-loop amplitude, it's from the triangles, and then at 6-point, you get bubbles, and 7-point, you get rational terms. And then they all stay there. That's the naive analysis. Actually, this might be a lot better. What we see is that at tree level, gravity is a lot better behaved than, say, we know from Feynman rules of KLT relations. We could have reason to believe that this continued. And, well, there could be cancellations across diagrams. We did the analysis for n equals 4. We did that diagram by diagram. And there were cancellations enough to take care of it there. There could be cross-diagram cancellations. Well, but again, there are no methods we know that show this, so we just have to start calculating. So, how do you calculate a one loop multi-gravitation amplitude? First thing you want to do is to compute all the box coefficients. Well, you start there because that's the easiest thing. Now, the way you do that is sort of, I want to say this in sort of a hand-waving way, but there's a way to say this a bit more precise. But if you want to calculate a particular coefficient of this diagram, particular one, then, well, it has these 4 internal propagators. So there's some place in the complex space of loop momentum where they all go on shell, so they would all produce singularities, that these are 4 singularities on top of each other, one for each of the propagators you're looking at. Okay. This gives these 4 overlap poles, and you can compute the residue of that. Now, it's only since there are no sort of pentagons, hexagons, it's only the box in question here that contributes to this residue. So, in fact, when you sort of think about it, the residue that you have is just the coefficient of this particular box function. it's a bit hand waving, but this is the way it goes. And, so taking the residue is equivalent to sort of removing the propagator and replacing it by a delta function in momentum squared. So what you do there is then, if you want to calculate this particular box in an, the coefficient of this particular box in an 8-point amplitude, you just cut those, which is setting them on shell, and you can there are four on shell conditions in four dimensions. They're fixed, and you calculate the product of these four amplitudes divided by two. There's a factor of two coming because, well, the solution here in four dimensions is actually not unique. There are two solutions, and this gives a factor of one. Okay, so actually, if you want to compute box coefficient, we just have to compute product of three amplitudes. So how can we use this for supergravity? Well, in the first step, well, we can try to compute boxes this way, and they reduce the product of trees. Trees we know either from KLT relations or from recursion relations where we believe we can get them. And we see the general trend. If you do calculations for, say, up to 7-point or for all image B boxes or so on, or image B amplitude, then we see that the boxes account for all the infrared divergences. So there are infrared divergences from a lot of places in this calculation, but the boxes actually describe them completely. We probably compute that using recursion relations, but again, we don't have a fail-safe proof of the recursion relations. We'd really like to have that.
There is a proof of the recursion relations in
super
amplitudes,
but not
in
supergravity.
So who would have done?
Well, if you believe that this behavior, as z goes to infinity, if you believe that this is that the amplitude goes to zero, then you can use complex analysis in the same way as you could in the Yang-Mills theory. Right, now we know the boxes, or the coefficients of the boxes. Now we want to know the coefficients of the triangles. Now, by using these infrared divergences, which we know we can rule out one and two mass triangles, because they would contribute infrared divergences also, which we could detect them. Three mass triangles are a bit of a problem. I don't want to say too much about them. You can rule them out, but it requires stuff like numerically integrating them and things like that. It's not terribly pretty. It can be done. So then we have to go to bubbles. For that we use the old unitarity cut technique, old meaning about a dozen years old, which is, I forgot to write it. It's normally due to Burring, Fix, and Dunbar and Kurzweil. Those you normally contribute. So what you do here is you take two internal momenta and two internal loop momenta and put them on shell. So this is done normally this way, that you make a cut of it. This makes the integrand a lot more simple, because then it's just a product of two free amplitudes. And this has a relation to the optical theorem. So there's something that describes unitarity in here. Okay. Now we normally have to remember to sum over two's multiplied if we have supersymmetric theory. And now what you want to do is to try to guess what the original expression was before you did this cut. Try to work your way backwards. You don't really want to do the integration if you can avoid it. Okay, you could actually do the whole integration. There are methods for that. So, but normally you might want to avoid that. So if you can write the integrand as a sum over something with two propagators in, and something with one propagator and something with nothing, then you're getting close to this decomposition into boxes, triangles, and bubbles. Because, well, if you have these two propagators sitting in here and here, it's sort of just the cut of the box. Now, of course, it needs to be consistent. So if you cut like these two internal momenta, then you would have to have a similar expression where these two ended up as propagators. Okay, so the sort of you have to do this consistently, and you can't always be sure you're right. Okay, but that's normally the way to go. So one of the things you could do to calculate them is to take what we had before and then do this. I call it a recursive shift here, but it's really an analytic continuation of the integrand of this curve. And well, even though it's a product of two tree amplitudes, you can still make the analytic continuation anyway. It just sort of, well, yeah, it's just, no, I don't want to say more about that. You can do it. There's no conceptual problem in that it's not tree amplitude to do it on, but a product of them. So from the same arguments, we know that if the integrand then goes as z to power minus 1, when z goes to infinity, we know that there must be at least one propagator somewhere inside here, because these poles are responsible for the propagators always. And then there can't be any bubbles, because, well, that was the last term before. It would correspond to, I mean, there has to be these propagators somewhere inside the expression, if there's a pole instead. Well, what we find when we actually try to do this is that if there's no summation over the Susi multiplet, it comes from the assumption that recursion holds for gravity amplitudes. There's a power of set to the minus 1 from each of the amplitudes. If we have a summation over the Susi multiplet, we don't as such expect the recursion to hold, but the summation just gives us, always ends up providing set to the power minus 8. And that saves us. That means that the whole integrand still has power of set to minus 2. And, well, now we've done boxes, we found out that we don't have triangles, we don't have bubbles, because we can do this. And, well, this is sort of we're sort of on different levels, and rationals is the last level, like, why would there be any? We've seen all the others have got their other arguments too, but that's sort of it's hard to really rule them out completely specifically. So the evidence for the no triangle conjecture is sort of this, that we have loads of circumstantial evidence that this sort of just has to be true. It's a rigid proof for n up to 6, because we know there are no rational terms there from the reduction. Then we can look at limits of factorization. If we have an n graviton amplitude and we let two gravitons go linear, then we actually get something that involves the n minus 1 point graviton amplitude. Well, if we know at low enough number of points there are no triangles, no bubbles, no rational terms, it's sort of hard to imagine where they would disappear in this process when we let gravitons go linear. So they have to stay there in some way. Okay, that's not a completely rigid statement, but, well. So the conclusion is that this no triangle hypothesis is a pretty firm conjecture. No proof, but it's a conjecture. All we have to be careful of is that all our arguments, not all, but a lot of them end up depending on these recursion relations being valid for gravity. Now we'd really, really like to know if that's right. So that was what I wanted to say about the one loop structure and the no triangle hypothesis. I'd like to end with a bit of all loops and stuff. So of course the reason why we're doing this is that we'd really like to prove that any say supergravity is ultimately finite. We've seen that the two theories are very similar at tree level. Okay, we have the KLT relations that relate them. We can make these MHD constructions for both theories. Now, a lot of the methods I described for one loop amplitudes actually run on tree level input. So if they're similar at tree level, you'd expect some sort of similarity at one loop level. That's what we see. And that's with a lot of these methods recycled into more loops. So we wouldn't, why would we expect this to stop at just one loop? Well, there's some evidence that it's not stopping. There are two and three loop calculations that confirm, I say, the general picture of that these have these similarities. Then there's, as Harold talked about, there's some input from other directions, such as that of Green, Visual, and Van Hoof. Next week, there's a conference about it at UCLA. So that's probably going to be interesting. What some people are guessing is that if n equals a supergravity is really ultraviolet finite, it sort of has to be because of the symmetry of the theory, but that we don't really know, that we haven't discovered yet. Now, supersymmetry is not really the whole answer. We saw this when we wrote down our one-loop Feynman diagrams and tried to do the reduction, used supersymmetry to remove 8 powers of momentum. That was just not enough. Something else that's helping us here. The general argument is that, well, n equals 4 super angles has the super conformal symmetry, this the extra conformal thing that comes in 4 dimensions. And, I mean, we have the KLT relations that relate at least tree level of these two theories. So n equals 4 has super conformal theory also. N equals 8 should, there should be something there. So say, like, where does the conformal symmetry go? On the left side of this, do something. Nobody knows what this is. There's no simple answer to that. Okay, so the conclusions be that recent calculational methods are strongly forward in our understanding of these things and a lot of other things. And the morale is that tree level feeds into loop level much more than you would have expected a couple of years ago. It seems that n equals 8 to gravity is closely related to n equals 4 to the angles, particularly with respect to the UV behavior, which is interesting. And as the last conclusion, I'd say that there's something out there that seems to be waiting to be discovered. Thank you.